Welcome back to season 6 of the Reconnected podcast. A few episodes ago, we had an incredible conversation with Dr. John McCarthy from Boston University about the psychology of coaching and the importance of teaching and learning in athletic coaching. In this episode, we're joined by Garrett Lukacs, who has not only been one of the best figure skaters in the world during his prime, but has since then taken his passion for the sport and his incredibly thoughtful approach into coaching competitive figure skating. In this episode, we're going to learn about his personal journey in figure skating, how he got into coaching, and then hear all about his coaching philosophy and program that he describes as athlete-centered skating. Just an incredibly thoughtful and powerful approach that is informed by sports science, psychology, and the field of education. How can I properly introduce Garrett Lukacs? Well, years ago, Alexis and I were so grateful to be connected with Garrett, where he, Alexis, and I would have endless conversations about the nuances of psychology, education, mental health, and sports. And lo and behold, Alexis and I started a podcast about these very topics. And what a treat this is to have Garrett come on to add to this conversation in such a rich and meaningful way. For the listeners, here's Garrett's robust resume. Garrett Lukacs is a retired competitive figure skater with accolades ranging from being ranked number 12 in the world, being a three-time U.S. world team member, a three-time junior world team member, and a two-time Olympic team alternate. His passion for the sport did not end once his competitive career ended. Garrett has gone on to coach competitive skaters since then for over 20 years. Garrett has won numerous coaching awards for his innovative ways of using sports science and psychology in his coaching, and most recently earning the U.S. Figure Skating 2023 Doc Councilman Science and Technology Award. This award is given to the best coaches in all Olympic sports. Garrett is a Team USA coach. He is a member of the U.S. Figure Skating Sports Science and Medicine Committee. He is chair of the Professional Skaters Association Sports Science Committee. He recently published a book titled A Constraints-Led Approach to Figure Skating, published in 2022 by Routledge. Following his time in Boston at the Skating Club of Boston, Garrett went on to bring his athlete-centered coaching program to the Detroit Skating Club, where he is the coach's education director. So to start, for any listener who is not sure if they're interested in a talk about figure skating, let me spark your interest. Recently in March, Boston hosted the World Championships. It's a rare opportunity to see the best figure skaters in the entire world. And it was hosted right here in Boston. It's an unbelievable event. The International Skating Union invited me to be part of a panel to speak on athletic resiliency and mental health. And that was alongside Dr. Catherine Ackerman and Dr. Margot Mountjoy, who spoke on relative energy deficiency in sports. That's Red S. It's a very important topic as well. And Alexis and I, we were honored to be able to attend the Friday event. It was the women's singles event for the World Championships. And we were absolutely blown away by their performances, their gracefulness, their passion, and even the sportsmanship was just breathtaking to be able to witness. At the end of the event, it came down to one final skater, American Alyssa Liu. And not often do I get to see an athlete perform at such a high level, but with such ease. It was a remarkable thing to witness. And the thing was that when you read about her story, it's quite interesting because Alyssa Liu at the very end actually won the entire event. It was kind of like a walk-off home run in baseball. You know, the very last batter in the end of the game kind of walks off with a home run. She was the last skater and she just blew everyone away and won the entire event. The story goes is that she actually retired from figure skating following some incredible early accomplishments as a youth skater. And the story goes that when she returned, nobody expected much because it's rare to do quite well after coming back from retirement. But when she came back, she actually found that she skated with a newfound freedom from all the pressure that she felt as a youth skater. And she was skating with passion and intention and more ease. And in my opinion, the side effect, what seemed to be the side effect of that, is that she won the entire World Championships event. And I think this is just an amazing story about the psychology of skating. And it's just one story of many. There's going to be plenty of stories that Garrett Lukacs is going to share today. He's an incredible person. He's just just has an incredible heart and incredible soul. And he's a gift to the world of sports. So we're so happy to have you today, Garrett.
Well, I'm so happy to be here talking to you both. You know, we as you said, we've had so many endless discussions together that they were so fun and so invigorating and inspiring. And, you know, that was such a special time that, you know, even as I'm coaching now in Michigan, I still look back on those discussions, you know, with the decision making that I have with my coaching here. So I'm just really happy that we're connecting, and I hope that we can share some fun stories, learn some more from each other, and hopefully our listeners will have something fun to get out of this experience as well.
I have to say that, you know, some of those conversations were the impetus for us starting this podcast, because how fortunate are we to get together and talk about such incredible, thoughtful, you know, ideas of how to continue to give back to the fields that we're a part of. And, you know, this conversation today will hopefully be an extension of that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I feel honored, to be honest.
So, okay, let's just talk about skating itself. Like, why did you go into figure skating? What was your allure with the sport?
Well, it's kind of a funny story, because I shared this on national television when I was a little kid. I guess the reason I started skating is because my parents signed me up. And so I didn't really, you know, I just sort of was one of those kids that wherever my parents took me, I just did whatever it was. So I didn't really think much of it at first. It was just that there was a local skating rink down the street from where we lived. And it seemed to be that was the cultural thing of that area. You know, everyone signs up for Learn to Skate, and there's this annual show that you do. And there are a lot fewer boys in skating. And so being a boy kind of gets the attention of coaches, because they want to have more boys to train. Mm. And so that kind of opened up opportunities to me earlier, like whether I was successful as a competitor or not, in that just the fact that I was a boy and there were coaches that wanted to train me. But the funny thing was, my interest or passion for the sport didn't develop until later on. And there was a challenge when I was kind of in my early teens of, hey, I didn't decide this when I was little. Like, this wasn't what I chose necessarily. It sort of like it was chosen for me. But I realized, well, just because it started that way didn't mean that I couldn't take ownership of it and make it my own. Mm. And when I realized I could do that, that I could say, well, sure, you know, I was brought up in this, but that does, you know, I can still take this and make it my own. When I finally did that, that kind of turned on what they call that rage to succeed.
Mm. Yeah, and describe that a little bit.
It's sort of the rage to succeed. I forgot the person who coined that term, but it's been around for a long time. And it's just this, I guess it's fueled by this intrinsic motivation, this internal drive to get better at something for just the mere sake of getting better. Hmm. For me, I'm a very like stubborn type of person who, like, you know, I'll persist at something and keep pushing myself, because I don't want to stop until I've, you know, I keep going up and getting better and better and better. Hmm. And that kicked in, you know, it kind of kicked in several different gears. So the first gear was when I realized that I could make figure skating my own. And then it really kicked in stronger when I was in my later teens, when I changed my training environments. And it was actually a very polarizing change from like kind of two opposite ends of a spectrum, so to speak, on not only like the way to be trained, but also the atmosphere that I was training in. Mm. And being put in that situation, it wasn't like, you know, oh, maybe I can adopt this new, this new culture or not. It was like, okay, I have to adopt this new culture, or it's not going to work for me. Mm-hmm. And I did, and this was a positive thing, and I did, and I turned was kind of a negative for me, which was that I didn't feel that I was training in a way that was effective for what I needed to do, into this desire to want to learn more and to know why. So like, you know, okay, why am I being trained this way? Why was I being trained in a different way before? And that ultimately led to my dive into the research literature.
So, you know, you brought up some really important points, because you were exposed to skating because your parents, you know, just introduced you to it. And I think that happens so often, right? Where parents are like, oh, just try this. And I love how you're describing that. It wasn't about them wanting you to do this that sparked your passion. It was more about your desire to want to improve and make it your own and make it something that you can really fully embody and embrace. And the thing that we've gotten to know about you over the years, Garrett, is that when you are curious about something, if you are on a mission or a goal for something, you devour as much as you can to learn as much as you can to do your best. And you just are like you said, just really set on this mission. And it's often driven by, I've noticed at least, like this passion to give back, to help, to serve, to support others who might also be interested in, you know, figure skating, which happens to be your role. But I would imagine if you were a chef, you might have that same passion, the same desire, and, you know, that same, you know, fuel that rages through you. I love that figure skating, especially as a male, is your passion and desire, because I think there's a lot of people who might not gravitate to that, that might really love it if they tried it.
Figure skating is a extremely challenging sport.
Yes.
Extremely challenging. And it is for that reason that I think that it can be such a positive, have such a positive impact under the right circumstances for someone, for someone's growth and development and maturation. And, you know, this story of my parents and having them put me on the ice and, you know, we'll say that in the beginning, they were the stimulus or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, throughout the years, that's been a big topic of you know, parental involvement. And also it's tied into ideas of athlete-centered coaching and, you know, autonomy support versus structure, where you know, structure does not have to imply a lack of autonomy support. And autonomy support does not have to imply a lack of structure. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by that in this case is, you know, just because my parents were the factor, the main reason why I was skating when I was young, and I didn't even decide to do it more or to add more hours or this or that. The important part is that and I think this is a good lesson for parents, is it's good to have structure for your kids. I mean, you know, my mom, her main rule was that if, you know, when I'm doing my training, she didn't want me to be wasting time. Hmm. And she didn't care what place I got. She didn't care, you know, how quickly or rapidly I was improving, but she wanted to make sure that I was using my time well. And when I look back on that, I think that that was a really healthy way of creating structure and boundaries for me, where she wasn't placing an expectation, like a controlling aspect of, you know, to please me, to make me proud of you, you have to win a medal or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that is a huge, there's a big difference there where, you know, I work with a lot of skaters and I see a lot of parents who they're kind of driven on the success side of the, you know, the medals and the external extrinsic factors. And while my parents did have structure for me, it wasn't centered on that.
Mm. Well, you know, and we've talked about this before too, my background in both Montessori education and universal design for learning are so closely related to what you're saying. And even thinking about the development of our prefrontal cortex, right? Which a lot of these young skaters, their brains aren't fully developed yet. So to have that structure and those boundaries are so important because, you know, I always say this is why adults are in the lives of children, right? We need to help to create some of those boundaries and that structure that they can work within, that they can learn within, and providing those options for autonomy and for individuality and to practice and try things out and to make those mistakes, I think is the most formative opportunity that we could have. And to do it through sport with a little bit of joy, I think is the most beautiful thing. Maria Montessori said, you know, we need to make sure that we have to have flexibility within our boundaries, right? We want to have those firm external limits, but have flexibility in how we reach our goals, how we navigate through environments, how we do the things that we do to learn and improve. And I have to just add in too, from an executive function perspective, that, you know, having these markers, these points where you can see improvement doesn't necessarily mean you're winning a medal or having the best performance ever. I'm frequently coaching parents, caregivers, and young people alike to think about the small improvements that they make that are so impactful to the greater goal, right? I know your skater-centered approach is really about understanding the process instead of just the outcome. And I think that's such an important point to make just for athletes, for skaters, for parents especially, to remember that it's about, you know, this journey that we're on, not just necessarily that everybody's going to get an award in the end.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the, you know, when you look back at the end of a chapter, and say for me, it would be, you know, at the end of my competitive skating, you know, once it's over, all you have is your experiences. And then, you know, you could say, well, I've got my medals. And I've always said this before, and I probably told you this when we first met, I have a bunch of medals somewhere in a box, and I'm very, you know, I feel very proud that I have those medals, but they're in a box somewhere. I don't even know where they are. But I can tell you all these experiences that I had, the challenges, the struggles, the people that came into my life, for the positive, the not so positive. I'm so thankful for that, because I think about that every day of my life. You know, and that is the most important part of sport. It can be such a robust way to build yourself as a person. And I know plenty of athletes who were very, very successful who did not walk away from the sport feeling like they had such a great experience. So we know that a fulfilling experience does not require winning a medal. I've had plenty of very negative experiences in just from sport in general. And I was one of those people who I chose to take those experiences into something positive, to help myself become stronger, but also as, okay, I see that these things have been happening or happened to me, and they can happen for other people. Now I could be a person who can come forward, who I certainly want results. I certainly want to develop high-level athletes who are winning medals, of course. But, you know, how can I do, you know, I want to do that. But the most important factor is developing the person behind the athlete first. So, you know, I came to the end of that chapter wanting to take that information and use it for something. And I think others maybe, and this is totally fine and okay for them, they decided to kind of close that chapter off and kind of start a new book maybe.
There's a psychologist, Nancy McWilliams. She's kind of a veteran in our field. She talks about what is mental health. We always talk about, like, what is mental illness? We don't talk about what mental health is. And one of her factors, there's many of them. There's a video on YouTube. It's a fantastic video about these 10 things she thinks. One of them is actually just love. And love, not only in relationships, not romantic love, but just love in aspects of your life. And part of that is wrapped up in exploration and genuine curiosity. And so it sounds like you were able to regain kind of a sense of that freedom as you got older. And as you said, you reclaimed that. Can you describe, you know, that in relation to the experience? Because I'm very much interested in the mental health of athletes, right? Mm-hmm. Can you describe that in terms of the experience of being an elite athlete with that kind of controlling aspect. You know, Dr. McCarthy in our coaching episode talked a lot about how in many ways sports nowadays has become almost like a compliance factory. Like you kind of, everything's about compliance. Do what I say, do what I tell you to do. He's like, coaches don't even ask questions anymore. They just tell them what to do. It's just, you know, like it's just not part of their dialogue. It's just, there's no questions, right? And so I immediately thought of you when he said that, right? Because, you know, how opposite that is to the way that you approach, you know, obviously you do tell people what to do to get better, but could you speak about just the emotional experience of being an elite athlete in these two different types of experiences? It's not an either or either, right? It's not like there's all structure, there's no structure, right? There's nuance to it, but just talk a little bit about the emotional experience of an elite athlete who's basically their whole life revolves around sport.
Well, I mean, you just, you opened up a lot right there. And, you know, you mentioned about coaching nowadays, and you also mentioned the word dialogue. Well, if you don't have questions, or if you're not talking to the athlete, then there isn't dialogue. The dialogue is a two-way exchange of information.
Well said.
Right. So, yeah, when it's just coming from the coach, that's a one-way transmission of information. And that's the controlling aspect of it. In order, if I'm a controlling coach or coach-centered, then what I'm looking to do is demonstrate my wisdom. And I just need you to comply with it. The athlete-centered approach, at least from my point of view, is sure, I have my wisdom that I've developed over time that's grown, but I use my wisdom to develop yours. The athlete. Mm-hmm. And to do that, so I'm kind of going down. You asked me one question, which I guess I'll get to after I talk about this.
Yeah.
But so the idea of developing the athlete's wisdom, and this is where my approach is kind of more influenced from the academic side of things. So this is like higher education research that I've read, where you know you have standards of performance. And, you know, in order for someone to get better at something, they need something to compare their performance to get better. Mm. Otherwise, you know, progress or improvement would be kind of luck or random or chaotic. And so if you think of like self-regulation and feedback loops and things like that, you know, a feedback loop works where, you know, the performer is, they're comparing their performance to a standard of some kind. And they adjust their general methods and pattern of performance accordingly. Mm. You know, if you get like a heating system in your house, obviously, if the temperature is set to 70 degrees, then the heating system, it's going to compare what the current temperature is to that standard. Mm. And then let's say if it's 65, then it turns the heat on and it brings it up to 70. The thing is, so, you know, that heating system is now an athlete, and that standard of performance, we know, it's not something that's supposed to be, that should be etched in stone or unchanging. We need to think of standards of performance as some sort of dynamic, evolving thing. And also that, coming back to me as the coach and using my wisdom, I have a standard of performance that I'm constantly growing and evolving, but the one I'm trying to develop in you, the athlete, it may be something different than mine. Mm. And that's okay. And my expertise comes in where, okay, you know, you're the athlete who I'm training and I'm developing your standard of performance. My experience comes in that I make sure that your standard is, let's say, you know, I'm going to take an analogy from author Kenneth Ginsberg. You know, I think of myself as sort of a lighthouse. I shine the light on the way, allow you to go forward, but I'm not going to let you go, you know, run your boat on the shoals and get, you know, stranded. Mm. So there's that balance in there of like, you know, I see things, you know, that I know what's expected by the judges. I know what different choices and decisions are made can lead to certain things. Again, obviously there's nuance in everything, but you know, if an athlete decides that they, let's say, don't need to warm up before they go on the ice, I know that that's not generally healthy. So that's where I would step in with my experience and try to guide them back on track, you know, not by demanding of them, but having a conversation about, well, you know, this is the benefit of warming up before you go out on the ice. This is how it can help you. What do you think about this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Rather than the directives, making it a teachable moment.
Right, right. And, you know, that same author, he has a term called choreographed conversations that I really liked. Mm. So this is talking about dialogue again. And it's sort of like, as coaches, we tend to just think of the skills, the physical skills that we need to teach. So for me, it would be teaching the jumps and the spins. But there's this whole life skill part of the process where, you know, sure, some people have different starting points than others, but I think of like self-regulation and, you know, the ability to make decisions for oneself. Those are skills as well. And I have to develop those in my athletes. And I start with them when they're very, very young. I look at it as like a bandwidth. And now these are some of my terms, but I call them choice opportunities, where when I'm coaching a lesson, and sure, I want to teach the physical skill, I'm going to try to embed opportunities for my athletes to make choices. And clearly when I'm working with a six-year-old, they're not going to be able to make choices that are long-term impactful on their training. But I can start with A or B choices, which is like, okay, do you want to work on skill A or skill B first? And, you know, the structure side of it is that I, the coach, I've made the decision that we're going to do these two skills, but I'm giving you the choice to decide which one is first. The answer may be inconsequential, but that's not important. What's important is that I'm teaching this little six-year-old, you're going to make choices. And so what starts out as something that is inconsequential, eventually it will be, because my goal is for that, you know, little six-year-old to one day no longer need to rely upon me. And so through the structure of the years of training, I'm going to expand that bandwidth where now they're making impactful choices on maybe their hour of training, or then maybe it becomes their week of training, and then there's their long-term choices. And that was the real fun that I've had with my athlete-centered program is one, realizing that kids at younger ages than I would ever imagined can self-regulate and manage themselves far better than I would have ever expected. Number two, they are far better at monitoring their progress and what they can do or not do and what they need to improve upon. Mm-hmm. And then number three, coming kind of back to the differences in standards, you know, we would do regular assessments with our athletes. And part of that process was that we would have categories like kind of psychological abilities or things like, you know, commitment to the sport, their coping, proactive coping, we called it, during their sessions or at competitions and things. And we found that these young kids were really good at doing that. And the even more interesting piece was that, because we would, you know, we'd have the kids give themselves a score from say a 1 to 5, and we'd give them a score from a 1 to 5. And then we'd find out, we'd prioritize, you know, which aspects we'd, you know, maybe two factors we'd want to focus on. Every once in a while, we'd find that a skater would come up with a very different number than we would. Sure. And so we would get their number first, and then the coaches would get together and talk about it. And we'd say, hey, little Sammy gave himself a really high score for this, and we kind of gave him a mid-range or a lower score. That's kind of interesting. And then we go have our meeting with little Charlie, and we say, okay, Charlie, why'd you give yourself that score? And we learned something profoundly interesting about what Charlie was thinking. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know, we didn't even think about that. And
do you want to hear the crazy part, Garrett?
Yeah,
I'm like smiling and nodding for those of you who are listening.
Yeah, this is great.
Because do you know how hard it is for me to actually train and teach and coach teachers to do the thing that you're saying that you do with your athletes? It's very difficult for them to pause and have students check in with themselves. And I genuinely think that is probably the most important thing at not just being an academic learner or an athletic learner, just being a learner in life to, as you say, and as we always say here too, to learn about ourselves and figure out what we need at different points in life. And I'm so glad you're saying that even the youngest skaters, the youngest kids that you work with have these abilities, because I think we make these assumptions that they can't. And we do a lot of compensatory, like, you know, let me just give you an iPad to regulate you in a long line or at a dinner table or when something might be boring.
I'll take it a step further too. Like in therapy, Lex, this is like such a good point you're saying. The people who I've found have really made long-term benefits from therapy are the ones who they're not just like, okay, tell me a skill to be able to like regulate myself or to get rid of my anxiety or to feel better, right? They're the ones where we have really good in-depth dialogue. They learn about themselves.
Yes.
It's very reflective. And at the end of therapy, when they're done or they like move on, right? I ask them like, what's gotten better? They're like, you know what? I'm really better at processing things that I'm experiencing.
Mm.
And Garrett, what you're doing is exactly that. You're helping people to process. Process more efficiently, process more with more clarity, understand why they're doing what they're doing, which you and Alexis always say is an essential part of any type of learning. Why are we doing this? What's the decision-making that you said, you know, like even making decisions. And also like if people are making decisions for themselves, that's autonomy, like you said, that feels good instead of just being told what to do all the time, right? That's engagement.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, you were saying about, you mentioned, you know, the quick fix of, you know, give me a tool to get me better. I'd say that I'm assuming that there are, you know, technological factors nowadays that kind of promote that in the world, you know, having access to answers on an iPhone for everything. And then in sport, you know, in figure skating, at the end of the day, you know, my performance as a coach or what I'm doing as a coach, you know, I'm watched by the parents all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like at school where your parents stay home.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is what can potentially be a challenge in sport, is that you want to have someone achieve a long-term goal, yet you have your client sitting watching every little detail that you're doing, that they might not necessarily know what it is that you're going for. And kind of what I'm really getting at here is, and I think when you said, give me a quick tool, there's a big difference between a short-term fix and a long-term solution.
Yes.
And in the motor skill acquisition space, they call it within session improvements.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can relate to this, Jerry, with psychology, I don't know, but I find that because there is like a monetary value put on a coaching session with me, you know, it's sort of like, okay, what is my child going to improve in the next 30 minutes with my coach?
Mm-hmm.
And whereas what I'm looking at is, what is this, how can I get this next 30 minutes to have a long-term impact on my skater? And the solution or the answer to that might not be to show a within session improvement.
Yeah.
It might mean that we have to struggle and make mistakes a little bit. It might mean that we have to, I don't look at it as taking a couple steps back, because
if
you're exploring and struggling, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, that is a hard sell as a coach.
Mm.
Garrett, this is exactly what happens in therapy. If you really want to work through something painful or challenging, right? We always say in our field, you might get worse before you get better.
Mm.
You might feel worse before, and it's not that you get worse, it's that you feel pain, you feel discomfort, right? That's actually exposure to things that are hard. And that is what makes therapy useful, is that you process difficult things, you work through it with the comfort and the safety of someone supporting you. And you play such an important role. I know what you're saying is important in terms of learning and growth, but it's also important that it's you doing that.
Mm.
And I really want to emphasize and point out that you being who you are and just having the attitude and the intention of caring about your relationship with your athletes, caring about providing a space that they feel safe to struggle, to be open and vulnerable, right? That is like being a good therapist. It's really, that's as important as the technique, as the learning strategy that you're using.
Yeah, I would say that it's the most important thing because, again, at the end of the day, I want to see my kids do amazing things on the ice. Mm-hmm. I want to be the coach of Olympic medalists and champions. That would be awesome. But if I want that to happen, I need athletes. I need children. I need skaters who can, you know, take control and feel good about what they're doing. Because if they do that, that allows them to achieve their greatest successes.
And to feel comfortable failing in front of you or being confused or asking a question or saying, hey, this is hard for me, right? That's the only way they can actually get better in the first place is to even admit it and be there with you and invite you to help them rather than feeling ashamed of it, right? Sometimes kids can feel ashamed or guilt or whatever, right? To even like be vulnerable in that type of way, which is perfectionism in its, you know, fearful form. We always talk about perfectionism could be helpful, but it's when it's driven by fear, that's going to create burnout. That's going to create, you know, not understanding what you need for yourself to recover, to be resilient. So like, yeah.
And it also stifles learning.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I think this is also, you know, this ties those topics together of academics and psychology and sport that we, you know, so passionately talk about. You know, helping, you know, not only kids, but also parents understand, well, what is the reason for all of this? And coming back to, you know, buy-in, you know, getting buy-in for what's going on. And, you know, the idea you mentioned about you have to, sometimes you have to feel worse to feel better. There were, from what I understand, Alexis, you'll know better than I would about this topic, but I did dip into it a little bit, but I kind of learned in academics that there were certain factors in place where the way the system was set up, that some of the teachers who were putting kids in situations where they did have to struggle and they did have to, as Jerry said, maybe feel worse to get better as far as, you know, their comprehension of a subject or their ability to self-regulate through something. It doesn't necessarily feel good in some points. And if you take an early on consensus of, okay, is this working or not? And you go on, well, I'm struggling right now, so this can't be good. And then now we change it. You're not really helping that long-term process. And I found that I have to have constant discussions with parents so they understand. In order for anyone to get good at something or to get better at something, they have to struggle. They have to make mistakes. And I also know that some of the, you know, top CEOs in the world, sometimes they put questions on their job resumes or the questionnaires. Tell me about your struggles. What are the three biggest mistakes that you made? Because they want to know that the people that they're hiring have made mistakes and that they're not afraid to talk about them and they've learned something from them.
I mentioned before that adults are in the lives of young people to help them build skills and navigate through challenges, to create some structure and boundary for young children to work within. But I think we've sometimes taking those boundaries a little too far, because the adults in the lives of children often will put, you know, a lot of rubber foam around those boundaries. They might, you know, actually have an air of anxiety that circulates those boundaries. And I think it's the adults sometimes that step in and are uncomfortable with their children struggling, which can often stifle the kids' experience. And I say kids broadly, right? It can even be adult children. When there's too much control, when there's that micromanaging and the discomfort with the struggle, it actually can impede this really beautiful organic opportunity to learn through a challenge and to be able to take things to the next level. And I see in what I've heard from the most elite athletes that I've worked with or known that they often had their tipping point where they found that they've pushed themselves or they've grown the most once they get to the other side of that struggle, right? There's a couple different ways of talking about it. Dr. Nottingham calls it the learning pit. You know, we talk about productive struggle. And I bring this up around and to teachers and parents all the time that that's actually where some of the greatest moments come from. In my book, I talk about how we can take like a moment and turn it into an aha moment if we allow to like allow ourselves to sit through that discomfort to get through to the other side.
Yeah, and there are definitely a lot of coaches that I know who, you know, they share in some of the values that I share in about this, the idea of struggle and the long-term development, but they feel pressured by the constraints of their business of, okay, you know, I have Sammy here coaching and Sammy's parents, they're paying me a lot of money and they expect to see Sammy improve and they're in that 30 minutes with me.
Yeah.
And so I have a choice to make. Do I, focus on the things that are going to make Sammy better for the long term, or do I give in? Because at the end of the day, I have my own livelihood and a family to feed. And now basically I have a choice to make between those two things. And it's a very hard choice for coaches to make. I don't blame any of them for, you know, let's say choosing one way or the other. It's very difficult.
Well, I think this is where what you said before, the dialogue and communication is so key between the coach and the athlete. But I think, you know, the athlete is an extension of a family, of a community, of a support system. And it's important to say, you know, what I say in my work, and maybe this is helpful for you too, Garrett, you probably have your own way of saying it. I always joke, I'm like, I know you think I have a magic wand. And sometimes it feels like I do. Mm. I said, but that's not actually the reality.
Yeah.
And my job is actually to collaborate with you and your child and their schools, if that's the case, or whatever the case might be, to work together on these goals that we're intending to aim for. Because ultimately we're aiming. And, you know, in any given week, especially young people, can have a number of factors that come up that they didn't expect or anticipate that can impact their performance, whether it's, you know, from an athletic perspective on the ice or with a test in school or in a social interaction. There's so many things that we just need to consider and just be mindful of the fact that, you know, stuff happens. And sometimes we need to take a step back and do what you are exemplifying in the way you think about coaching and ask the question, what do you think we could have done differently there? What do you think we want to tweak or improve next time we try that? Instead of it being, oh, you nailed it. We're good. You were successful. It's like, okay, what do we learn from this experience? And that's the takeaway instead of the complete execution, which of course that's the goal you're working towards, but we need to be able to have those steps in between to get there.
Yeah. And this can kind of tie into the distinction between like learning and performance in motor skill acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
So they say that the very conditions that may seem ideal for learning may not be ideal for performance and vice versa. And that, you know, let's say the basis for how you judge a successful training session is on how many jumps you landed.
Mm.
Well, then now you're basing it off of your performance and not learning. And there was one very interesting study done. It was an expertise study on figure skating maybe 25 years ago. I forgot the researcher's name. I can't remember. They came out of the study, the researchers saying, well, it's very interesting to see that even expert figure skaters seem to just work on the stuff that they already do well.
Mm.
And so like our sport, I'll just speak more, you know, on our sport, but our sport is very performance oriented in that even when you're practicing, there's this expectation to perform well. And, you know, it's kind of influenced by a lot of different things because number one, it's sort of like, well, if you fall, then that means it didn't go well, or at least you think it didn't go well.
Mm.
But then it's, you know, what is the first question parents ask their kids after they get in the car? Oh, how did it go with your axel jump? Or, you know, how many triple sow cows did you land?
Yeah.
And now you're basically putting, the child's learning that, okay, success means my practice, a successful practice means I stood up and landed my jumps, and a bad practice means I fell on everything.
And their worth.
Right. Yeah.
You know, Garrett, it's funny when I see a skater land a jump, my brain immediately goes to how many times did they fall before they got there? Because that's like, so that's my measure of success is like, how many times did they have to get back up again and then keep going to get to where they are right now in this competition that I'm able to see?
Countless times. You fall and fall and fall and fall. And it is, and you keep falling.
Yeah.
And this part of our discussion about performance and learning is like one of the huge things that I start with when kids are young too, because I've even found that even when I nurture this in a young child who's like 5 or 6, because I have the interesting situation where I can start working with a kid when they're 3 until when they're 23.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I get to see them grow and learn through decades, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. But I found that even children who I have like nurtured to think, you know, to kind of measure their practice success based on what they've struggled, the difficult things they've chosen, sometimes when they hit certain different points of their lives, that can sort of, you know, other factors come into play, so to speak, where
totally.
you're thinking, what are all those things we worked on when we were when they were younger?
So, Garrett, during the Healthy Skating, Healthy Skaters seminar, which was at the World Championships, the panel, right? This is exactly the point that I brought up, is that if you don't reflect on what your needs are, you're not going to be as resilient as you can be. But if you're not really reflecting on what influences how you're doing, how you're feeling, right? Which is so many factors, right? It could be things going on outside of skating. It could be, you know, relationship. Maybe you feel like you're not having fun, right? Because you're just so wrapped up in the sport. Maybe you're not doing other things. Maybe there's stress at home. Maybe there's all these factors that could get in the way. It could even be confidence, right? Which is like, you can be so prepared for a performance and then you lose your confidence leading up to it. And you're not going to be able to do what you could do, right? Because of that lack of confidence in yourself, the belief in yourself for whatever reason. And so like, and I believe that this is part of your program too, is to help people to like reflect on what their needs are. When do they perform their best? What are the factors that are involved in it? And all the things that you bring to the table absolutely help facilitate that. And there's so much to it that could influence how someone's feeling and how someone's performing.
Yeah, I mean, I relate that to, and you can jump in if I'm off here, but, you know, simply being reactive to situations versus gathering tools to equip yourself and make you better prepared for the future situations. So like one is more of a reactive way to approach where, you know, something happens and you just sort of react. And then the other one is you use your reflection to be future oriented, so to speak. So that's kind of an important thing to me. Is that kind of like what you were saying or?
Yeah, I think it relates, right? Like, because things are always going to happen in life. You can train perfectly well for a competition, and that doesn't mean your life is going to go perfectly well. There's going to be things that are going to influence it. So we can either, as you said, be reactive and kind of let these things kind of pull us down and kind of get in the way of, you know, how things are progressing, or we can learn how to cope. As you say, we can learn how to process, right? Reflect on what's happening and work through it. Use resources to get support. So many athletes who are elite athletes, they're super competitive. They don't want to ask for help sometimes because they want to prove that they can do something by themselves. They want to be super independent, right? There's that. That's kind of preventing long-term resiliency, not only in sport, but in life. So your approach of helping athletes reflect on themselves goes even deeper than just performing better. It goes into just, you know, resiliency over the long term.
So thinking about this idea of resiliency and thinking for the long term, I think it's really difficult for children to do that. And it's important for all of us as adults in their lives to remember that developmentally, oftentimes they are just in the moment. And it might seem mindful or it might seem impulsive, but really it's their brains might need some extra scaffolds and supports to see how what's happening here in the moment will impact them in the future. And then later in the future to remind them of the journey that they've been on to get to where they are. So I think this is the important part about what you're talking about too, to be able to build that resiliency to be able to help support them for their long-term role and goals in what they're doing. And I'm thinking about your approach to athlete-centered coaching, and I wonder if you can kind of break it down to talk a little bit more about what exactly that looks like. Is there like a recipe or a guideline that you often use or you teach coaches to use in interacting with the athletes and the skaters that they're working with?
So I think, you know, we talk about recipes and things like that in ways. And you mentioned earlier that the recipe can always be changing. And I talked about standards earlier, and I mentioned the word dynamic standards, which means that things are always evolving and changing. So for me, like, it's important to you know, mention again, like, I think it's good to have some guiding principles. With my approach, I would call it, my approach is athlete-centered. And then, you know, how I, you know, take that approach into action, there's many different ways that I would do it. It's just that I have, you know, the guiding principles in front of me that, you know, obviously every person is different. You know, children can have similar experiences and have extremely different outcomes. They can have extremely different experiences and have similar outcomes and this and that. But at the end of the day, there are some things that we can, you know, tools that we can use as coaches to, you know, not make sure everyone's on the exact same pathway, but to make sure that children are growing and developing and becoming, you know, a capable human being who will be able to enter the workspace one day when they get older.
Yeah.
And with coaches, I think, you know, we talked about this earlier, but I always come back to this idea of developing the athlete's own standard of performance. And having coaches, trying to teach coaches to understand. In fact, I'm going to be giving a lecture at the U.S. Figure Skating's Axis of Excellence camp in May, in 2 weeks, about this exact topic of yes, I am the coach. I have expert knowledge. I have wisdom to share. But I need to use that in a way to help make this person in front of me, who is uniquely different from everyone else, into having their own. And, you know, we have to look at the sport in general, and figure skating is a judged sport, which means that people are looking for certain things to look a certain way. You know, a triple salchow jump has to sort of check off a few boxes, so to speak, kind of like maybe a rubric at school, in order for it to even count as a triple salchow. So we do have the structure in place, and my athletes, they have to understand what that triple salchow should look like or could look like to get a high score, but I can still develop their, you know, the subtleties that can go around that, which, you know, maybe they have a preference for one top athlete's triple salchow jump versus another, and it might not match mine. And that's okay. And so I think one of the biggest things that I like to talk to coaches about is, you know, you're not trying to get people to comply with just your standard. And, you know, you demonstrating what you know doesn't necessarily mean you're being helpful to the athlete.
It's great. It's very humanistic psychology of you. And there's a lot of work of Abraham Maslow and Scott Barry Kaufman who talk about this idea of self-actualization. And it's directly in line with what we've always talked about in universal design for learning, right? That you have the goal, you know what the triple salchow looks like, you know what those mechanical components are, but how you're going to teach it and how you're going to get there might differ. And it might be look like a different path depending on who the athlete is and what the entry point and what those points of progress monitoring are until you get there.
Yeah, and Garrett, you're so wise to say someone could do the same thing and have a different experience with it. Mm-hmm. And I love how you said, like, okay, let's take this particular person's technique, and that's the one you want to emulate rather than another one. And the reason that's so profound is because, you know, in like psychology, we always say like, what is the, Alexis always says too, what is the behavior telling us? What's the meaning of it? And as a coach, it's easy to look at behaviors as just behaviors. They did something, they didn't do something. Mm. And to ask why, or ask what the meaning of that behavior is number one, extremely validating to a person. Mm-hmm. So like if someone makes a mistake or doesn't do something the exact way you expect them to inquire as to why is extremely valid. It honors the person. It doesn't suggest, oh, you didn't want to do it or you weren't trying hard enough. Which in sport, in this like elite, you know, sport atmosphere, work harder, try harder, you're not working hard enough, right? Sometimes kids get gaslit. Mm. You know, being gaslighting in the sense of like being blamed for something that is not actually their fault, mm. as in like, oh, you didn't try hard enough, or you're not putting enough energy into it, or you don't care enough, right? When on the surface it may look like that, but it actually may not be that at all. And all you have to do is inquire and have a relationship with the athlete to have that, as you said, dialogue, to understand the cognitive process, like what was going through their head and their feelings that led to the behavior. It's profound, Garrett, you know, doing that. It's really important.
Well, I mean, what you're kind of talking about to me is, I mean, these are some of the components of being autonomy supportive, right? So to be an autonomy supportive coach, I need to acknowledge the feelings and perspectives of my athletes. And again, knowing that their feelings and perspectives most certainly could be different than mine, and there should be no surprises there if they are. And, you know, we talk about giving them choices to make decisions about things, and providing rationale for what we're doing and why we're doing it. Because if you provide mm-hmm. rationale, then that certainly could increase the chances of feeling good about buying into it or not. You know, having the choice to buy into whatever the training that you provide. And, mm-hmm. you know, this comes back to kind of, you know, now the idea of structure and autonomy support and how they both can be harmonious with each other. So, you know, you, an athlete come to me. Well, first of all, I ask you, well, what are your goals? And let's say that this is someone who's a bit older and they say, well, I want to, you know, qualify for the US championships. Okay. So then I would say, okay, well, then you need to do A, B, C, and D to get to those goals or something like that. You know, this is what your training would be. That's where I provide the structure. Here's what I'm providing or offering that you should do if you would like to achieve those goals. Okay. Now, if you want to buy into that, now we go do our training. And where I keep the structure in place is, okay, if I see you are, you know, you bought into doing A, B, C, and D, but I don't see you doing C and D. Maybe it's an aspect of your off-ice training, or it's, you know, using your warm-up time or whatever. Then we have another discussion. I say, okay, we talked about you doing A, B, C, and D. C and D are not happening. So we can either change your goals to match up with what you're doing now, or we can ramp up that C and D so we can get ourselves on track. And that is how I provide the structure, but it's still autonomy supportive because at the end of the day, they have choice. They have choice that they were able to, they set their goals, not me. And, you know, my relationship with this athlete is not reliant on them achieving their goals. So my relationship with you is the same, you know, whether you do them or not. And then, you know, then you also have the choice of, okay, do I really want to commit to these things to achieve the goals that I have? And so there's lots of choice layered in there.
And Garrett, it's even more profound than that, because when you kind of check in at these checkpoints, right? Okay, you're doing A and B, but you haven't done C and D yet. Rather than shaming the kid or saying like, why aren't you trying hard enough to get to the higher level? Inquiring is extremely important. Like working as a therapist and a sports psychologist, you get to actually understand what the person is going through. There could be a plenty of reasons mm-hmm. that are conscious or unconscious, right? Sometimes kids are just afraid to get to the next level. Mm. There's some fear, right? Oh, okay. If I actually try harder, then I have this pressure, right, to actually confront the goal that I set a long time ago. The expectations are going to change. People are going to see me as this amazing athlete, and therefore I'm not going to be able to have any mistakes anymore, right? I don't know if I want that pressure, right? That's one example. There's plenty of other examples of why, but you're not just assuming the behavior means, oh, they don't care or they're lazy or so forth, right?
No, of course not. And, you know, as I always say, as a coach, you know, my coaching, it has a lot of psychology tied into it, but I am not a psychologist. So when it comes to those types of things, I know where like my boundaries are as a coach, where I need people like you as my support system, because if and when those situations come up through the dialogues that I have with my athletes, then I have expanded my tools on how I can support them. And at the end of the day, the last thing I want to do is create a controlling situation where, you know, again, the athlete's success is, you know, our relationship is riding on whether or not they medal or they comply with what I want them to do, because it doesn't work. It creates this what they call a vicious cycle where, you know, once that pressure is there, it might get some short term reaction, but then the vicious cycle of it is it goes away, and then the behaviors or whatever that happens resumes, and then now pressure applies again. And it's this horrible thing that I don't coach for that. I'm not interested in that at all. And I've seen it around me a lot, and I think I'd be involved in something else if that was the only choice.
I think it's so important because, you know, one of my sayings that I find myself saying more often than I would have hoped, but I keep sharing with people that I can't always change the darkness that might be around me. I can only control my own light. And I think that's a lot of what you're doing in figure skating in terms of coaching, is really shining your light on the process in developing not only great skaters, but great human beings who are developing skills along the way. Because especially for, you know, I look at a lot of figure skaters who, you know, sacrifice a lot. Sometimes they're not in traditional schools if they're really at a high level of competition. And they might be kind of isolated. They might not always have as many social experiences as, quote unquote, a traditional student might have. And it's a different path. And for you to see that in them, because I know that was a lot of your experience too, and for you to acknowledge and really embrace their journey to help them learn about themselves as they're learning the skills to be a great skater is just such a beautiful thing. I appreciate you shining that light so brightly. And I interviewed and had a conversation with Dr. John McCarthy from BU about coaching. And I think what Jerry was saying in the introduction is we wanted to talk to you about this because you really embody this idea of being a coach of coaches, a coach of human beings that are developing, not just athletes, which I think is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, you're only a kid once too, Garrett. You know, like these kids are, they're their kid once. I mean, it's okay. Sometimes we lose childhood experiences. We try to recreate that as we get older and earn ways to bring back the joy that we may miss out on. But if kids are, in all sports now, if kids are at an elite level, they're so involved in their sport. It's like a job. It's like they are going to work every day. And why would we want to create conditions where kids are just not having fun, enjoying, or have any type of love or relationship that are like meaningful in this environment? We wouldn't even want adults to experience that, let alone a child. So, you know, what you're doing is really, really meaningful, Garrett. It's appreciated.
Well, thank you so much. And that kind of brings it back full circle to the beginning when I was talking about early specialization sport. And one of the biggest challenges that I had when I first hit the research literature was I was looking for, well, what are they talking about with figure skating and research literature? And it was basically only about it being an early specialization sport. And, you know, I could see that it was like just the way that it was talked about, it was kind of like a frowned upon thing, because in general, you're looking for, you know, diverse experiences and to, you know, engage in different things and to grow and develop and this and that. And, you know, here I am in this sport where you're coming to the same place every day for hours and hours a day. And I don't know if you remember this, Jerry, but I actually had talked to you about it a while back. I almost was wondering if I'm doing the right thing by being in a sport where I'm telling parents of young kids to be good, you have to come in every day. And I don't know if you remember, do you remember this conversation? It helped me a lot because it helped me realize that, you know, coming back to, you know, having different experiences in different situations is that I realized that I can have kids come in and make a commitment to this, but it can be engaging and enriching and it can be all these amazing things. And gosh, you know, when I talk to my other friends who did many, many different sports and different things, and they would talk about, you know, me and the sacrifices, so to speak, that I made, I don't really look at it as sacrifices. I looked at it as opportunities. You know, I had an opportunity to, you know, let's say I'm doing, you know, five different sports a week. Well, I could say that by doing the one, you know, with the right support system and mindset, when I hit a struggle, I get to face that struggle down. And I don't just, you know, have to like shove it to the side and forget it's there. Then, you know, now I can do something else. And now I can do something else. I had the opportunity to have to deal with something, get to a point where I'm going to hit a brick wall, you know, with my progress, so to speak. And now I've got to find a way to cope through it and to work through it. And that's how I'm going to become a stronger, more capable person. And I don't think if I had that experience, there's no way I would have written a book. There's no way I would have been a guest speaker at Boston University on genetics for a pathophysiology course, which I never studied in high school or college. So I am so thankful for that. And it's not to say that someone who's sampling and experiencing many different things can't, but what I realize now is that just because you're really engaging in something as like figure skating and all the kind of demands of what you need to do to be on successful, I feel okay knowing that I'm putting my athletes in a healthy environment when they do it.
Yeah. It's like when you look back on your favorite teacher, you know, that was an important person in your life that you think fondly about as you go forward. Garrett, I have one last question for you. And it's kind of setting the stage for, you know, the way sports are and it's a little bit in line with what we just talked about. In the age of just being exposed to everything, right? Here's the best skater in the world. Here's how they're training. You're going to see behind the scenes videos of all the things they're doing, the skills they're doing that are like well beyond what a youth athlete should be able to do, right? Like, and they see all this stuff, right? They see, oh, this is the nutrition. This is like everything that is going perfectly well to reach the top of the top.
Garrett mentioned it, optimization, right? This idea of how do we optimize everything?
Optimize. It's literally in the air, right? It's in the air or it's in the, I don't know, electronic
waves.
Yeah. Right. Do you feel like it's important as a coach to encourage parents and kids to not be afraid to just not do something sometimes and to experience and this is not an all or nothing. I'm not saying like just stop skating or like take like a couple week, like take a month off, right? To do little things throughout their experience in sport, to not be afraid to not do what they think is like the perfect thing to do to become the perfect athlete, to get into the perfect next step, whatever that is. I mean, because I hear that with sports a lot where like there's this ethos of like, you have to do everything perfectly well to get to the best college, to get into the best program, the best this. And it's like a fear-based thing where it's like, oh my God, like if I'm not doing everything that way, I can't take care of myself. I can't like go hang out with my friends on Saturday night. I can't do this. I can't. And it's a self-reinforcing cycle that like feeds on itself.
Yeah. You know, I like to think of it as, well, I mean, it's the same thing, but not being not afraid to do something, but to feel really good about doing something. So
yeah. Both things.
So the whole idea of, this outcome and how this feeling that every little decision that you make is going to have an impact of whether what college you're going to get into or not, that fuels all these short-term things that we were talking about this whole session on, within session improvements and, the expectation of trying to make progress and, not having time for struggles or this or that. That's a huge potential pressure on this whole journey. And, at the end of the day, there are certainly, there's a lot of, to be great at anything, you have to put time into it. That's for sure. To be great at figure skating, you've got to be on the ice for a long, long time. You have to be strong. You have to be flexible. You have to have a level of artistry. There's so many things that go into it, but none of that matters if you're not a healthy individual on the inside. Mm. And sometimes perspective is a really valuable thing. So getting away, actually one of the greatest lessons I learned from my coach who recently passed away from those tragic events. And this is a Russian coach who, they're notoriously known for, pushing. He was the first coach to tell me, Garrett, get out of the rink and go rest.
Oh,
go take long walks. Go get out in the air, breathe the air. And I think that's a really vital piece is sometimes you got to step away and step back to get that breath of air. So you have some reflection, you can piece some things together, and then you can come back in. And that ties into who our current world champion is, Alyssa Liu. Mm.
Yeah.
I think that's a great way to wrap up and a beautiful tribute to those who've paved the path for the work you're doing now. And thinking that sometimes we can just step away, take a moment, take a breath, and reset ourselves to figure out what the correct next step might be.
Yeah.
And the people that are going to best bolster, support, and nurture that. And I'm grateful for you, again, sharing your light, shining your light, being a part of our lives and the lives of all the athletes and families that you have the beautiful honor and opportunity to work with.
Yeah. And Garrett, we're so sad about your loss, just to validate and acknowledge what you have been through in the past couple months with the tragedy that happened to your coaches. I don't know if there's anything you do want to say just in tribute of them in terms of their role in your life. I know you just mentioned something, but if there is something, if not, that's okay too.
Well, my coaches were Vadim Naumov and Evgenia Shishkova. And so they were on the plane that crashed. And, Vadim and I, we were such an interesting matchup because, I was his first student in the U.S. and he had just retired from his own skating and they were world champions together. And we were such an interesting pairing because we had so many things that were similar about us. And then we had so many things that were very, very different. And the one thing that we both had was that we were both like lifelong learners. And, he came from a very successful system, the Soviet Union sports machine, but it wasn't necessarily a effective system. So there's a difference between successful and effective. And I think he recognized that really, really well. And, I'll never forget that when I gave my first classroom lecture at a coaching seminar, the first person to walk in the door was him. The first coach that walked in the door was him. And, of all the things that happened in our career, in our lives together, and obviously winning U.S. championships with him was obviously amazing. But seeing him walk in the door to learn from me, his student, was such a profound moment.
I have the chills.
Wow. What a show of respect to you as a person in your life.
100%. And to what type of person he was.
thank you so much for sharing that. And if anything, you know, this story represents relationships. What's more powerful than that?
Nothing.
Well, with this all being said, Garrett, thank you so much. This has been an incredible conversation. We miss you here in Boston very much. And we hope to have you come on here again to talk more about your wisdom, but hopefully just to spend some more time with you. And maybe we'll try to take a trip out to Detroit to see your new digs out there.
That would be so fun.
We're really grateful for you, Garrett. Just sending so much love to you and the skating community. It has been a really tough year, but also, you know, hopefully some bright spots that can continue the tradition and the wisdom and the honor of the sport as we continue to move forward. So thank you for all that you do. And again, for all who you support.
Thank you both as well. And I agree 100%. And I really can't wait to see you both in person again and continue on from where we left off.
Thanks so much, Garrett.
Thanks for tuning in to the Reed Connected podcast. Please remember that this is a podcast intended to educate and share ideas, but it is not a substitute for professional care that may be beneficial to you at different points of your life. If you are in need of support, please contact your primary care physician, local hospital, educational institution, or support staff at your place of employment to seek out referrals for what may be most helpful for you. Ideas shared here have been shaped by many years of training, incredible mentors, research, theory, evidence-based practices, and our work with individuals over the years, but it's not intended to represent opinions of those we work with or who we are affiliated with. The Reconnected podcast is hosted by siblings Alexis Reed and Dr. Gerald Reed. Original music is written and recorded by Gerald Reed. Editing and recording was done by Cybersound Studios. If you want to follow along on this journey with us, the Reconnected podcast will be releasing new episodes every 2 weeks each season. So please subscribe for updates and notifications. Feel free to also follow us on Instagram at Reconnected Podcast. That's Reed Connect Ed Podcast, and Twitter at Reed Connect Ed. We are grateful for you joining us and look forward to future episodes. In the meanwhile, be curious, be open, and be well.